This poem is one of mine, the Mad Poet's Love Song. I live profligately, dispense big words for free, buy books for a single phrase and then return like some odd fish again and again to the source. I am promiscuous. I leave books in my bed, fall asleep clutching stories I've only just met. They wake me later, but never remember my name. Mad women love this way, and thieves, giving everything for style, for the flash in the mind, the pull at the gut. Risking everything, old loves, old views, for the day's perfect word, a phrase that caresses. Don't mock me. There is a strange fidelity in falling asleep to the chatter of the printed page and waking to the morning paper. No? Try filling your mouth with rhymes and spitting them slowly like watermelon seeds across the lawn. Then come back and tell me I'm wrong. I'm not sure when I started writing poetry. Perhaps when I was around 10 or 11. I also have no idea why I started writing poetry. I suppose, like the infamous mountain, because it was there. If, of course, you can describe an unwritten poem as being there. Something wanted to be written, so I wrote it. My earliest attempts at theology were, I suppose, much the same. I do recall that when I was perhaps in junior high school, coming home from a commencement ceremony for Starking School for the Ministry, or UU Seminary in Berkeley, that I would graduate from many years later, and writing down a little thesis on the nature of good and evil. As I recall, good was attributed to Santa Claus, whereas all evil was attributed to a kind of alter ego, anti-Claus. Now, by virtue of said seminary education, I can identify that theological standpoint as a kind of idiosyncratic Manichaeism. I could not, however, tell you either what inspired the thought or what drove me to write it down. For me, poetry and religion are just there, part of the underpinnings of life. I'm not sure that I've ever tried to define, let alone describe, why either one should matter, let alone what one might have to do with the other. I could tell you that at some point in my life, I came to realize that in one sense or another, every poem that I wrote was a religious poem. But I hadn't bothered to think about how or why that might be the case, until one day when I got an email from the Reverend Gary Kowalski saying that he had been invited to deliver the Berry Street essay to the UU ministers before General Assembly that year, and the topic was poetry, and since tradition dictates that the Berry Street essay has a responder, he thought it would be good to have a poet do the responding. Now, let me point out here that the Berry Street Conference was founded by William Ellery Channing in 1820, and I wasn't going to let a little thing like, say, not having any idea what to say on the topic of poetry, stopped me from participating in the 190th Berry Street Conference, if only as dessert after the main course. If Gary was willing to have me say my piece on religion and poetry, I was certainly eager to give it a go. So, thanks to Gary, here's the conclusion that I came to. Religion and poetry are the same thing. Or more precisely, religion and poetry do the same thing. Like a blender and a food processor, they may not look alike, but the function is the same. Blenders and food processors pulverize. Religion and poetry connect little things to big things. Religion and poetry connect little things to big things. Religion is about all of the stuff that is too big to know in any absolute way. Love and death and evil and good and meaning and ultimate reality. Religion is about the things that are beyond words, and about the words that we use to approach those realities. What is the kingdom of heaven? Well, whatever it is, it's beyond definition. But in trying to answer the question, Jesus speaks of it in terms of the tiniest, most mundane things. It is like a mustard seed, quite literally the tiniest thing, which grows into a branching bush that the trees can nest in. It is like yeast that a woman hides in flour, and the yeast leavens the whole 3 measures of flour. We begin to know the things that we can't know by way of the ordinary things that we do know, right? Poetry does the same thing. It takes the most mundane, particular things around us and attaches them somehow to the things that our hearts know, but our minds are not able to articulate. Let me offer you an example, because I'm here and you're here and I can't resist. Let me be so bold as to make that example a poem I wrote entitled Mozart and Manner. You don't expect to find such a thing on a common Chicago sidewalk, a mobile hump of tortoise casually navigating the cracked concrete. Of course, I know how the absurd breaks in, shuffling the deck of our expectations. God is, if anything, perversely creative, a practical joker of the first degree. But still, a tortoise is a tortoise, odd enough in its own reptilian context, without wandering city streets in that determined tiptoe amble, pretending that one could just as easily be at home in this world anywhere, anywhere at all, even the corner of Mozart and Manor. It's a tiny story, and for what it's worth, a true one, a factual one. I was walking in the neighborhood where I used to live in Chicago, and I saw a tortoise walking down the sidewalk. What makes it poetry, rather than just an oddity to mention at dinner, is the poem's temerity in suggesting that we might all just possibly be tortoises, awkward and out of place and entirely welcome and at home in this odd location called life. The little thing bumps up against the big one. Actually, metaphor, poetry, does something a bit more extraordinary than bumping little things against big things. Metaphor claims that something actually is something else. As you may recall from some long ago English class, a simile asserts that something is like something else. My love is like a red, red rose. But the heart of poetry and the heart of religion is not simile, but metaphor. Something is not merely like another thing, it is that other thing. The wide universe is the ocean I travel. You and I are certainly not tortoises, and yet the poem hints we are. Metaphor, poetry, religion insist that we are not merely similar to the things around us. We are, in some impossible way, one and the same thing. One of the pleasures of a seminary education at Starking School for the Ministry many years ago, when I was a student there, was the opportunity to be in deep conversation with Bob Kimball, who was then the president of the school. There were some interesting challenges to those conversations, as it was notoriously difficult to make heads or tails of anything that Bob said. But the challenge I remember most particularly was that Bob refused to allow the use of the word about. You could say whatever you liked, just not using the word about. Religion, he said, dove into the heart of things, whereas about circled around the edges. About, he claimed, was a distancing word, and so we did not talk about any subject. we engaged in it, or we analyzed it, or we worried it with our metaphorical teeth. And although it made for some very awkward sentence construction at the time, I understand now, although not then, what Bob meant. Religion is metaphor, not simile. We are not like the rest of the world. We are the rest of the world. Blenders and food processors pulverize, making multiple substances into one homogeneous mass. Poetry and religion leave the components intact, but layer them in such a way that each piece becomes translucent, whole and yet permeable, visible and yet allowing the other elements to shine through, like those pictures of the systems of the human body printed on transparent film. You've seen those, right? We are our bones, but look, we're also our veins. See, we're our organs, but at the same time, we're this vast matrix of nerves. The central truth of religion is the paradox of metaphor. It is absolutely true that each of us, human or tortoise, is a little thing, distinct and particular, with our own smooth or bumpy skin, our own deliberate or striding walk. We are each of us individuals, beautiful in our own peculiar way. That's the first principle of Unitarian Universalism, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. However, it is equally and paradoxically true that we are all one unified big thing. Call it spirit or life or the universe or God. Throughout time, mystics of all traditions have sung and danced and meditated and prayed and fasted in order to touch that elusive experience of unity with all creation, the sacred truth that we are all one. Rumi, the 12th century Sufi poet, says, "You're sitting here with us, but you're also out walking in a field at dawn. You are yourself the animal we hunt when you come with us on the hunt. You are in your body like a plant is solid in the ground, yet you're wind. You are the diver's clothes lying empty on the beach. You're the fish. In the ocean are many bright strands and many dark strands like veins that are seen when a wing is lifted up. Your hidden self is blood in those veins that are lute strings that make ocean music, not the sad edge of surf, but the sound of no shore." We are our particular selves, but we are also the unity of all that is, the ocean that has no shore. That is Unitarian Universalist's seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence. We are the tiny things, the clothes on the beach, the fish in the sea. We are also, inside and beyond any particular thing, awash in the great ocean of life. Metaphor is the only way you can say these contradictory things and have them both be true. Here's how I put it in a poem entitled Boundaries. The universe does not revolve around you. The stars and planets spinning through the ballroom of space dance with one another quite outside of your small life. You cannot hold gravity or seasons. Even air and water inevitably escape your grasp. Why not, then, let go? You could move through time like a shark through water, neither restless nor ceasing, absorbed in and absorbing the native element. Why pretend you can do otherwise? The world comes in at every pore, mixes in your blood before breath releases you into the world again. Did you think the fragile boundary of your skin could build a wall? Listen. Every atom is humming its particular pitch. Of course you are a symphony. Whose tune do you think the planets are singing as they dance? Your life is a tiny, insignificant thing. Your song is the song of the spheres. Of course, it isn't possible. It's just true. But religion is not just words, it's action. However, it's a particular kind of action. It's action in which we hold the pieces together up to the light so that the big things shine through the little things and the little things through the big. In a wedding ceremony, we hold the particulars of a relationship between two people up so that the grand concept of love can shine through. And in the wedding, we see love through the faces of those two individuals. When you shake hands with a visitor at church, hospitality and welcome are clasped between your palms. When you show up for a march or a vigil or a rally, what you do, walk down the street or chant or stand around, becomes a religious act because justice walks with you. When you sing the children out of the room and you ask that God goes with them, you are God going with them. In religion, in poetry, the big things and the little things slip inside one another and become impossibly the same thing. The hymn puts it this way. The lone wild bird in lofty flight is still with thee, nor leaves thy sight. And I am thine, I rest in thee. Great Spirit, come and rest in me. Metaphors be with you. Blessed be. Amen.